Good to have all of you this morning. Appreciate so much your presence and your interest in spiritual things and your willingness to come and study the Bible. We'd invite you to open your Bibles to the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah. I listened to the class from Wednesday night, and I don't think you talked specifically about the book of Nehemiah. And so we're going to talk about that some this morning. You see on the board Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi deal with this period of Old Testament history. And it, to me, it's just one of the most fascinating periods of history because it indicates the providence of God to carry out the things that He said He would do. A lot of people don't appreciate studying Old Testament history. But as one fellow recently pointed out to me, he said you can sure understand the New Testament a whole lot clearer if you are acquainted with some of this Old Testament history. Now, in our study, Randy has been giving us the rule from time to time. The rule is you do what God says and He will bless you. That's what He said to the Israelites. And He was with them when they did the things that were right. But He told them that if you do the things that are wrong, I will oppose you. And I will bring up nations against you, and they will become an oppression unto you. When He brought them into the promised land, the land of Canaan, certainly that was so during the period of the judges, under 15 judges, about 305 years. We find that they were in and out and in and out. They served the Lord. They were unfaithful. And then there was an oppressor, and then there was a deliverer or a judge. And they went around that horn about 15 times. And then they asked the last of the judges to make them a king. And Saul the son of Kish became their first king. And then he began to rebel, and God forsook him. And then we learn that David became king. And during the time of David's reign, he did some really bad things, and there were some awful consequences that were imposed upon him. And then we learn that David's son Solomon became king. Solomon likewise did some really bad things, and there were severe consequences. Solomon intermarried with the heathen nations round about him and took multitudes of wives and wound up worshiping the idols that the women that he had married worshiped. And as we look at these things, we see this: you do what I say and I'll bless you, you don't and I'll curse you. We see that occur over and over and over in almost every cycle of the Old Testament history. But what I have on the board here is consistent with what God had said regarding the Assyrian Empire. I believe it is in Isaiah chapter 9 or 10, where the prophet Isaiah said that the Assyrians would be the instrument, chapter 10, verse 5, that the Assyrians would be the instrument in God's hands to bring His wrath upon the northern kingdom now after the kingdom has divided under the reign of Rehoboam. These maps to me are very, very impressive because here you see little Judah. It's this little spot. Here's the great empire of Assyria. And here's this little spot of Judah during the time of the reign of King Hezekiah. And Hezekiah is faithful to God. He's not worshiping idols. But during this time, Assyria has conquered everything else except Judah. And they tell the king, you need to surrender to me and I'll spare you. You'll have horses and lands and so forth and so on. And Hezekiah said, I will not surrender. And you recall then how that the king, through his captain, challenged the people on the wall and spoken to them in the Hebrew tongue and told them, you need to implore Hezekiah to surrender because if you don't, then consequences are going to be tragic. And of course, Hezekiah did not surrender, and Richard is not in here right now, but if he was, he would tell you that 185,000 of the army of the king of Assyria died or woke up dead, as we use that expression. And then the king of Assyria marched right back up here to Nineveh, the capital where his two sons killed him. Now, that leads to the next segment as far as our map is concerned. You don't see the Assyrian Empire on this map because as you continue reading in Isaiah chapter 10, we know that God was going to raise up the Chaldeans. And the Chaldeans would indeed conquer the Assyrians, and whatever captives the Assyrians have taken, the Babylonians now have control of. But where's Judah on this map? It's gone. What's happened to Judah? They now have kings, unlike Hezekiah, who worship idols. And so Judah is taken captive by the Babylonians. And then God said that he would raise up a man named Cyrus. We read about that also in Isaiah chapter 44, the last few verses, and on into the first few verses of chapter 45. And the dating of Isaiah was about 200 years before Cyrus became king, long before the Medo-Persian Empire was ever established. In fact, we find that Cyrus came to the throne and did indeed write a decree, just as God had said, that would allow those who were Israelites, if they desired, to go home and rebuild the city of Jerusalem, rebuild the temple, and once again establish themselves in the city of Jerusalem. As he did that, time passed. And there were waves, as we've used that expression, to describe their return. You talked about group number one, group number two, returning while I was away in the meeting. And when we talk about group number three returning, it was not a large group of folks, but it was with Nehemiah and those who were in his company who were to come and to rebuild the walls around the city of Jerusalem. Now, Haggai had already come, and in about 520 to about 516 B.C., the city, or the temple rather, of Jerusalem had been built. But the city is not fortified. The walls still lay in ruins, so it's still subject to someone conquering the city. And Nehemiah was one of the captives that is now cupbearer to King Artaxerxes, the fifth king of Persia. You'll note that this man reigned from about 465 to about 424 B.C. He was the third son of Xerxes. Now, the thing I want you to remember about dates is this, that it was about 444 B.C. that Nehemiah returns to build again the walls around the city of Jerusalem. Now, we're going to talk about the book of Nehemiah and the character of Nehemiah rather extensively in our study this morning. So I want you to open your Bibles to the book of Nehemiah so you can see the things that we're going to be talking about. In Nehemiah chapter 1, we know in verse 1, he tells us that he was in Shushan, the palace. It says that Hanani, one of my brethren, verse 2, came, he and certain men out of Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews that had escaped and were left of the captivity and concerning Jerusalem. And they said unto me, the remnant that are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. And the wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. Now picture the magnificent temple that at this point has been completed under the direction of Haggai the prophet. And Haggai has had to pop the whip at the heels of these folks to get them to build the temple. And now here's the temple, but everything around it lies in ruins. And so things are not in good shape. Nehemiah is told that here in this text. Now, as you drop down into the text, verse 4, it says, it came to pass when I heard these words that I sat down and wept and mourned certain days, and I fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Now, listen carefully. When there is a problem that's very, very distressing, what's one of the first things that you need to do? Pray about it. Pray about it. Now observe that. Nehemiah prayed before God. Notice that he's distressed. He mourned about this. But he fasted and prayed to the God of heaven. The privilege to talk to the God of heaven is one of the greatest privileges that those who are Christians get to enjoy. Nehemiah was an Old Testament prophet. He was in fellowship with God. And he had the opportunity to pray to God. And in verse 5, look at what he said. I beseech thee, O Jehovah, the God of heaven, the great and terrible God, that keepeth covenant and loving kindness with them that love him and keep his commandments. Now what's he said about God? Who is God? What did he say about God? All right, God's faithful. You see that? God is faithful. Now, speaking to a faithful God, he says in verse 6, let thine ear now be attentive and thine eyes open, that thou mayest hearken unto the prayer of thy servant, which I pray before thee at this time, night and day, for the children of Israel, thy servants, while I confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against thee. Yea, I and my father's house have sinned. We have dealt very corruptly against thee, and have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, nor the ordinances which thou commandest thy servant Moses. Remember, I beseech thee, the word that thou commandest Moses, saying, if ye trespass, I will scatter you abroad among the peoples. But if ye return unto me and keep my commandments and do them, though your outcasts were in the uttermost part of the heavens, yet will I gather them from hence and will bring them unto this place that I have chosen to cause my name to dwell there. Let's pause again. Nehemiah recognizes the greatness of God. He recognizes the faithfulness of God. He reminds God of the promise that God had made. He had made it all the way back throughout their history. What was it?
If you obey me, I'll bless you. If you disobey me, I'll curse you.
Isn't that simple? Here's what you said. Now what have we done? We've disobeyed. That's right. Now because we've disobeyed, where were we or where are we? We're scattered among the nations. And we're scattered among the nations because we did the very thing you told us not to do. But you also told us that when we repent, you'll bless us. Now, we've repented and we're back. You brought the people back into the land. Now, look, if you will, at verse 10 of chapter 1. Now, these are thy servants and thy people whom thou hast redeemed by thy great power and by thy strong hand. Redeemed from what? Where were they? All right, they were captives. And now they're free. They're brought back into the land that God promised them. And they're brought back into the land, you'll note by verse 10, by thy strong hand. That's exactly what God said he would do, isn't it? You do what I'll tell you, and I'll bless you. Who brought them back in? God did. And if you look at verse 11, O Lord, I beseech thee, let now thine ear be attentive to the prayer of thy servant, and to the prayer of thy servants, who delight to fear thy name, and prosper, I pray thee, thy servant, this day, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. Now look at that little expression that follows. Now I was cupbearer to the king. What man is it that Nehemiah desires that God would grant him favor before? The king. King Artaxerxes. You see, I'm a servant of the king. I want to gain favor before the king. Now, in chapter 2, it says it came to pass in the month Nisan, and the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king, when wine was before him, that I took up the wine and gave it unto the king. Now I had not been before time sad in his presence. And the king said unto me, why is thy countenance sad, seeing thou art not sick? This is nothing else but sorrow of heart. Then I was very sore afraid. Question. Why is he afraid? John? Well, do whatever, yes. This is the most powerful king in the known world. And this most powerful king is telling him, what's wrong with you? You're not of the chipper, cheerful disposition that you always are. This is nothing but sorrow of heart. What's wrong with you? Now, you would want to answer that very carefully, wouldn't you? And I said unto the king, let the king live forever. For why should not my countenance be sad when the city, the place of my father's sepulchres, lieth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire? Now that's a very simple statement. He tells the king, why should I be any other way but sad? The burying place of my fathers lies in ruins. It's destroyed. Now, look, if you will, at verse 4. Then the king said unto me, for what dost thou make request? So I prayed to the God of heaven. Let us see that Nehemiah believes in the power of prayer. Now, we might sit back and say, well, I'm just one fellow. There's not a difference that I can make. But what is it that Nehemiah does when the king, the top man in the world, asks him, what can I do? What does he do? He prays. Yes.
I'm thinking it was a pretty fast prayer. I'll answer you when I get back from my prayer. He probably said a quick prayer.
Well, perhaps so, but our point here is he has the opportunity to ask the most powerful man in the world for help. Now you see, you want to think that thing through. What do I need to ask for? How can he help me? Now, we might reason and say, well, Mr. King, what I'd like for you to do is to form a big committee and give them all the money that they need to hire a great army and go in there and rebuild the city. But now wait a minute. Nehemiah is cupbearer to the king. That gives him access to the king, but does that give him a position really of power and authority? No, not like Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who were made heads or presidents over provinces. Nehemiah doesn't have that role. He brings wine to the king.
He has access,
but no power. That's right. Now look at what he asked for in verse 5. I said unto the king, if it please the king, and if thy servant have found favor in thy sight, that thou wouldest send me unto Judah, unto the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it. Now, did you catch that? He doesn't ask for an army. He doesn't ask for a team of laborers. He doesn't ask for money. He said, send me so that I can go build it. Now, sometimes, brethren, we don't see what one fellow can do. Just one fellow. Now, we've made the point a number of times that one fellow and God make a majority. Don't discount the power of prayer. Don't discount what you can do. When we look at this text, he said, send me that I may build it. Now, in verse 6 it says, and the king said unto me, the queen also sitting by him, for how long shall thy journey be? And when wilt thou return? So it pleased the king to send me. And I set him a time. Now let's pause there. What was it that Nehemiah prayed for? Yes, Juan? Oh, well, that's not good. I won't answer that one. Go ahead.
The cupbearer, though, would be somebody that was held, maybe not in office, but to the king, that was an important thing. That person had to be trustworthy.
Sure.
And they couldn't, because of how many people would be trying to kill him, but they would have to have the king's utmost trust and respect.
That's true.
So that is a very high,
that's right.
Like maybe not an office, but that's a very high esteem right there.
Yes. He's privileged to have that place. Yes, that's true.
And so the king would probably look to him like anything you want, because you have not killed him yet.
Okay, well, that's true. Randy?
Of course, it's speculation what he prayed for, but I think it can be assumed that he prayed that he would say the right thing, and that he prayed that the king would say the right thing back.
Well, that's right. Back up, if you will. I think it's more than speculation. Look, if you will, please, in verse 11. In verse 11 of the preceding chapter, chapter 1. O Lord, I beseech thee, let now thine ear be attentive to the prayer of thy servant, and to the prayer of thy servants who delight to fear thy name and prosper. I pray thee, thy servant, this day, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. What is it that Nehemiah is asking for?
The New American Standard says, make your servant successful today and grant him compassion for this man.
Yeah. So what's he asking for?
Success.
Yes. Before the king. In other words, that the king might respond favorably, or that I might be able to be of some help, some advantage to the people this day. Now he goes in before the king, and the king says, how can I help? And Nehemiah says, send me. And look at how the king responded. How long are you going to be gone? When will you return? In verse 6, it pleased the king to send me. Has he found mercy or compassion with the king? Yes.
I think it's important to notice also that this wasn't the first time he prayed.
That's right.
He's been praying for several days, and then he goes before the king and prays again.
All right, this is not a once-in-a-lifetime thing for Nehemiah. That's right. What we see in Nehemiah's life is established a pattern of prayer, communicating with God. And that establishes confidence in God. God can do something about this. And I think that's seen in the earlier portion of his prayer. Yes, very good, Randy.
That brings up an interesting point I was going to ask you earlier, back in chapter 1. Back in verse 4 of chapter 1, when I heard these words, the words about Jerusalem being broken down, and the gates are burned, I sat down and wept and mourned for days as I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. It just made me wonder, how old is Nehemiah and why would this trouble him so much? I mean, if he's been one of the captives for years and years and years, and then he hears that, you know, some of the captives have returned, and he hears word that the gates are burned. Well, everybody knew that the gates have been burned for 70 years. What I mean is that city has been desolate for 70 years. What is it about that breaks him up all of a sudden?
It's still that way. See, Haggai, during this time frame, Haggai's gone back and he's found that he kind of had to pop a whip at their heels to get them to build the temple. And Malachi writes about this time, maybe just a little bit later, but we find that the condition of the people is very apathetic and indifferent. So Nehemiah's distressed that it stays that way. There's nothing been done about it.
You keep saying Haggai, but Ezra, the one that cracked the whip, Haggai just prophesied about it.
Well, yeah. Let's go back to the book of Haggai. I think Haggai fusses at them considerably.
Right. He's there in Jerusalem doing that, but I think it was Ezra, the one that came and kicked them all, right?
Well, yes. Yes.
He was the mover and the shaker, and Haggai was the prophet.
Yeah. Well, that may be true. Oops, just lost my book. Haggai. In Haggai chapter 1, you might do the math on verse 1. In the second year of Darius, the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of Jehovah by Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, saying, thus speaketh Jehovah of hosts. Now he's growling at them considerably. Calls upon them to consider their ways, because you built your own house and the house of God lies in ruins. So though Haggai has a great deal to say to them, you'll note in verse 4 of chapter 2, he says, yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith Jehovah. Be strong, O Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Be strong, all ye peoples of the land, saith Jehovah, and work, for I am with you, saith Jehovah of hosts. So, you know, as far as who's present among them, popping the actual whip, perhaps we could say Ezra is, but Haggai from a distance is popping the whip at them too. They've got to do this if they're going to please the Lord, and if they don't, then again, the consequences will ensue. But the temple was built. And looking at what Nehemiah does, Nehemiah wants to go. I want to do something. And the king says, how long will you be gone? And so he set him a date. Now in verse 7, it says, moreover, I said unto the king, if it please the king, let letters be given me to the governors beyond the river, that they may let me pass through till I come unto Judah. And a letter unto Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the castle which appertaineth to the house, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall enter into. And the king granted according to the good hand of my God upon me. Now, Nehemiah is brave. What can I do to help? The king says. Nehemiah said, send me. All right, how long are you going to be gone? He gives him a date. Now, Nehemiah, what else you need? I need letters to the kings along the way to allow me safe passage, and to those who are the keepers of the king's forest, that they can give me building materials so that I can build the walls around the city of Jerusalem. And the king granted him these things. Notice the last expression of verse 8, according to the good hand of my God upon me. What has Nehemiah found that he requested of God?
Everything he asked for.
Yes, compassion. He's found mercy before this king, most powerful man in the world, has granted him permission to go and lead in the rebuilding, and has promised to supply him letters where he will have the supplies necessary to rebuild the walls around the city of Jerusalem. Now, when he went beyond the river, I think the river here has to do with the river Euphrates, and he gave folks the king's letters. We've already found that with the rebuilding of the temple, there was opposition. And with the rebuilding of the walls, there is opposition. And you read, beginning in verse 10, it says, and when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant, the Ammonite, heard it, it grieved them exceedingly, for that there was come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. Now these men, I think we identified Sanballat the Horonite as from among the Samaritans, and Tobiah from, as it says here, the Ammonites, and we're later going to read about Geshem in verse 19, who was an Arabian. These were the enemies of the people of God. Now, why would they oppose the rebuilding of a wall around the city of Jerusalem? What is it that the Samaritans and these other folks did while the Israelites were over here in captivity? They moved in. Yeah. So it's not like we can just come back and everything's just like it was, and we can just start building. They found there were people that had just moved in, and they didn't want the Israelites to rebuild in territory that they now claim. And so they present opposition. Now when Nehemiah comes in verse 17 of chapter 2, verse 17 of chapter 2. Oh, by the way, Randy, when you consider the time element, some have said, and I think our lesson book says, that 140 years have passed since Jerusalem had been burned. We know that it was certainly 70 years just during the time of captivity. But keep in mind, after the decree of Cyrus, we've moved on now five kings down. Yes. And Nehemiah still in Persia, serving as cupbearer to the king. So time has passed on. But nothing's been done about the city as far as the rebuilding of the walls. 90 years since Cyrus gave permission to go home.
He must have been raised right.
No kidding. Yeah. Somebody taught him something. Now there's a novel thought. Yeah. Exactly right. But the problem is, you see, plenty of time has passed for them to have become prosperous again, but they've not done so. And so it makes you wonder, well, what in the world is going on? Now, I'm going to pass beyond this chart. If you want to figure these numbers, I'll be happy to show it to you later on. But it shows when the first captives were taken captive, and it does the math for us. So with this one as well, brings us down to this date, 444 B.C. And this shows us the rulers, the period of time during which they reigned, Cyrus and Cambyses, and then Darius or Darius the First, Xerxes, and now Artaxerxes. This is the one that Nehemiah served. Now, Nehemiah, I want this on a separate chart because I want this to be hammered home. Nehemiah was a man of action. He wasn't a man to sit on the sidelines and watch somebody else do it. And sometimes that's the way we find ourselves behaving. Here's a big job that needs to be done, but it's anybody's job but mine. And who winds up doing it? Nobody. Now, Nehemiah was not like that. Nehemiah saw something that needed to be done, and he asked that he be sent in order that this might be accomplished. We see evidence of the power of prayer. The petitions of the king, or to the king, send me. But there's some preparations that needs take place. Beginning in verse 9, it says, "Then I came to the governors beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent me with captains of the army and horsemen. And when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant, the Ammonite, heard it, it grieved them exceedingly, for that there was come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. And I rose in the night, I and some few men with me. Neither told I any man what my God put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. Neither was there any beast with me, save the beast that I rode upon. And I went out by night, by the valley gate, even toward the jackal's well, to the dung gate, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and the gates whereof were consumed with fire. Then I went on to the fountain gate, into the king's pool, but there was no place for the beast that was under me to pass. Then I went up in the night by the brook, and I viewed the wall, and I returned back, and entered into the valley gate, and so return." And verse 16 says that the rulers didn't know why I was there. They didn't know what I was doing. Well, what is it that Nehemiah is doing? If you're going to build a wall around such a tremendous city, you need to see the work that needs to be done. Take inventory, so to speak, of the work that needs to be done. Now, in verse 17, he begins to declare why he has returned. Verse 17. "Then said I unto them, Ye see the evil case that we are in, how Jerusalem lieth waste, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. Come and let us build up the wall of Jerusalem, that we be no more a reproach. And I told them of the land of my God, which was good upon me," or the hand, rather, "of my God, which was good upon me, and also of the king's word that he had spoken unto me. And they said, Let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for the good work." Nehemiah is a bearer of good news, isn't he? I come with the commission of the king. I come from the answer of the prayer of God to come and rebuild the city. Now they say, "Great, let's get with it. Go to building." But look, if you will, at verse 19. "But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant, the Ammonite, and Geshem the Arabian heard it, they laughed us to scorn and despised us and said, What is this thing that ye do? Will ye rebel against the king?" Question, were they rebelling against the king or carrying out the king's wishes? They were carrying out the wishes, the commandment of the king, what they were doing. Now, if you'll note in verse 20, "Then answered I them and said unto them, The God of heaven, he will prosper us. Therefore, we his servants will arise and build. But ye have no portion, nor right, nor memorial in Jerusalem." Now, just very simply put, Nehemiah tells these who are the enemies of God's people, who do not want anything done or accomplished that would benefit the Israelites, "This is none of your business." Now, do we see that? None of your business. What you need to do is just go away. You have no part nor lot in this matter. I'm here by the commission of the king and an answer to the prayer that I made to God. And so you just go away. It's not your business. You don't have any part, you don't have any right, and you don't have any memorial in Jerusalem. What did the Israelites have in Jerusalem? Their ancestors were buried there. Yes, what else did they have? Their whole history, everything was there. In fact, now the temple is there. So, well, back up. Nehemiah then begins to arrange the people so that they can do the work. And we'll just abbreviate for sake of time in our study this morning, the most of the third chapter, with the expression, you and your family work on this part, and you and your family, you work on this part, and you and your family work on this part. Is that sufficient for chapter 3? That way I don't have to pronounce all those names. You see. Now, beginning in the fourth chapter, it tells us in chapter 4, beginning in verse 1, but it came to pass that when Sanballat heard that we were building the wall, he was wroth and took great indignation. Now, who's Sanballat? The Horonite. That's right. One of the Samaritans. And he said he took great indignation and mocked the Jews. And he spoke before the brethren and the army of Samaria and said, what are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they make an end in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubble, seeing they are burned? Well, that's pretty serious criticism, yes.
It's interesting. He talks about them being feeble Jews, indicating that they don't have the ability to accomplish this. Evidently, he had convinced them of that up until Nehemiah came.
Yes.
It took Nehemiah for them to make the change from we can't to yes, we can.
Yes. Same thing with the building of the temple.
Right.
Yeah.
And again, not that Nehemiah relied on his strength or wisdom or anything. Obviously, he relied on God. But it took Nehemiah to change that from we can to yes, we can.
That's right. Very interesting observation. And sometimes we feel defeatist. We can't do this. But yet, we can. God has never assigned a responsibility to any people but what they could carry it out. And we must see that. He doesn't expect us to do the impossible, but if it's possible, beloved, He expects us to do it. And here we are with Nehemiah. And He persuades the people to that end. Well, Sanballat laughs at them. You're going to turn these stones, heaps of rubbish, into a wall? And then you'll notice in verse 3, it says, and Tobiah the Ammonite was by him, and he said, even that which they are building, if a fox go up, he shall break down their stone wall. Now you see such a ridicule as that. Well, what they build is not going to be substantial. Even if a little fox walks on it, it'll all fall down. But notice further in verse 4. Nehemiah says, hear, O our God, for we are despised. What's Nehemiah doing again? He's praying. Now again, friend, don't you ever underestimate the power of prayer. Look at what these folks are doing. Hear our prayer. He said, and turn back their reproach upon their own head and give them up for a spoil in the land of captivity and cover not their iniquity and let not their sin be blotted out from before thee. For they have provoked thee to anger before the builders. So we built the wall. And all the wall was joined together unto half the height thereof. For the people had a mind to work. Oh, such lessons. The wall went up. Now, you know what they had to do to build the wall halfway up. They had to clean up a mess. It was in rubbles. They had to clean the path where the wall was going to go. And when they get it halfway built, they've accomplished a great deal. And why did they do that? Because the people had a mind to work. You can take a whole lot of folks that are kind of lazy and indifferent and take forever to do nothing. But you can take just a handful of folks who have the mind to work and accomplish a great deal in short order, can't you? Now that's what we see here. The people had a mind to work. Now as the people had a mind to work, they kept building. But what did that do in the minds of their enemies? Look at verse 7. But it came to pass when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabians and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the repairing of the wall of Jerusalem went forward and that the breaches began to be stopped, they were very wroth. And they conspired, all of them, together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause confusion therein. Now you see how that would present a problem. You see, they have... what's the word I'm looking for? That they have...
The vendetta?
Yeah, that's not the word I'm looking for, but that'll do. They gathered together allies. So it's not something now that just we're trying to do. We're going to incorporate everybody into this. Anybody we can find to slow down the work. So we're going to war against them so that we can defeat them in the work of rebuilding. And verse 9, look at what he did again. But we made our prayer unto God and set a watch against them day and night because of them. And Judah said, the strength of the bearers of burdens is decayed. And there is much rubbish so that we are not able to build the wall. And our adversaries say they shall not know, neither see, till we come into the midst of them and slay them and cause the work to cease. It's getting serious, isn't it? We've got some hindrances along the way. There's more work to be done. There's more rubble to be removed. And the enemies say that they're not going to sleep until they've caused us to stop the work on the wall. Now it came to pass, verse 12, that when the Jews that dwelt by them came, they said unto us 10 times from all places, ye must return unto us. Drop down to verse 14. And I looked and rose up, and I said unto the nobles, to the rulers, to the rest of the people, be not afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and terrible, and fight for your brethren, your sons, and your daughters, and your wives, and your houses. Now, when he calls upon them to remember the greatness of God, what would be evidence of the greatness of God that they might remember? Pardon me? Aren't their history, their whole history. The dividing of the Red Sea, the coming across the Jordan River. Now, all of these things would be things that they would have heard of. But what perhaps have they seen?
Temple's rebuilt.
Temple's rebuilt. Yes. The temple is rebuilt. Nehemiah, prophet of God, he's here. You remember the great things that God has already done. Now, as you view that, verse 15, it came to pass when our enemies heard that it was known unto us and God had brought their counsel to naught that we returned, all of us, to the wall, everyone to his work. Now notice again, they're not distracted. It's really easy, is it not, to meet with opposition. We become distracted. Other things become more important to us. And once the work has stopped, we just don't ever get back to it. You ever been there? Well, all of us have. Now that's unacceptable. Look again at the text. Verse 16, it came to pass from the time forth that half of my people wrought in the work, and half of them held the spears, the shields, and the bows, and the coats of mail, and the rulers were behind all the house of Judah, and they builded the wall. And they that bear burdens laded themselves, every one with one of his hands wrought in the work, and with the other held the weapon, or his weapon. And the builders, every one, had his sword girded by his side, and so builded. And he that sounded the trumpet was by me. And I said unto the nobles, and to the rulers, and to the rest of the people, the work is great and large. We are separated upon the wall, one far from another. In what place soever ye hear the sound of the trumpet, resort ye thither unto us. Our God will fight for us. Now, let's make some conclusions based on what we've read. The people are working. They'll not be distracted. The distractions are there, but they belt on their swords and they take up their shields and they work. They're prepared to defend themselves should they be attacked. And Nehemiah has the trumpet blower right nearby so that if he orders everyone to concentrate in a certain area, they'll all be there. They're ready to work. But they're also ready to fight. Do you see that? Now sometimes the least little distraction, the least opposition, we're ready to quit. Do you see anything in this that indicates their willingness to quit? Friend, underscore in your thinking, there's not a place to quit. There's just not. There are all kinds of things that become distractions to us, and the devil is described as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. He won't quit. Now, there's not a place for you to quit. There was no place for them to quit. Their confidence was in God. Our God will fight for us. Now, in verse 21 through the next two or three verses, rather interesting text, it says, "So we wrought in the work, and half of them held their spears from the rising of the morning till the stars appeared. Likewise, at the same time, said I unto the people, let every one of his servant lodge, everyone with his servant lodge within Jerusalem, that in the night they may rather be a guard to us and may labor in the day. So neither I, nor my brethren, nor my servants, nor the men of the guard that followed me, none of them put off his clothes. Everyone went with his weapon to the water." Now, there are a couple of thoughts on that. Some think that what this means, very simply, is that they slept with their clothes on. I suppose that's probably true. But you know, before long, you become a little ripe when you've had your clothes on for a long period of time. But notice, if you will, what did they do if they even had to wash their clothes? Took their weapons with them. Never let your guard down. Now that's their attitude. That's what happened. They never let their guard down. Now, how long do I have here, Richard?
That's not very long. It just reminded me of Ephesians 6 in terms of putting on the full armor of God. Now, Paul talks about to put on full armor, he never mentions taking it off.
That's exactly right. Never mentions taking it off. Has to be proved. You put it on, you use it. Any other questions or comments? Randy?
I was just trying to understand the mindset of the enemies and thinking about these are the ancestors, these are the descendants of the people that the Jews wiped out or were supposed to wipe out when they first came in hundreds of years earlier. And that now under the rule of Babylon, they've been living in peaceful coexistence in this land. But Jerusalem's been laying in ruins. So over the last few years, they've seen the temple go up, and they're thinking, wait a minute, aren't these the people that wiped us out? You know, our ancestors? You know, they're going to do this again. You know, I'm just trying to get the mindset of the enemy, the Ammonites. I remember who they were.
They were the descendants of Lot.
Lot, yeah. And then the Horonites were Samaritans. The Ashdodites, I think, were Philistines, weren't they?
I think so, yes. Ashdodites. Yes. And of course, the Samaritans, this mix.
The Philistines had great history with God.
Yes.
Yeah. That's why they hated it.
Yes. Just an interesting thought now that we're out of time. The Philistines were the ones who were iron workers. They were the ones that had the swords. They were the ones that had the tools that had to be sharpened, and the Israelites took theirs to them. Wouldn't it be a bit of irony at this point if the Israelites are using swords made by the Philistines to fight away the Philistines? Well, we don't know that, but it's an interesting thought. Keep reading in Nehemiah chapter 5. In Nehemiah chapter 5, we're going to see that as determined as the people were for the walls to go up, chapter 5, the walls stopped. We'll talk more about that next time.